Well, let me begin by thanking Ivan and all of those who are responsible for affording me this opportunity to come and share my thoughts with you this afternoon. I must say that I'm very pleased and gratified to be here. This is my first time in Edinburgh, and I must say that I am very profoundly impressed with what I've seen so far. In the interest of time, I'm just going to dive into my presentation, and hopefully there'll be some time at the end to entertain questions. My introduction to Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi's latest opus, Fiqh al-Jihad, or Jurisprudence of Jihad, was actually quite serendipitous. Soon after arriving in Cairo this past summer, I proceeded, as has become my habit, to cruise the bookstores. I was particularly interested in anything that could shed additional light on the substance of, or general response to, Egypt's notorious Al-Gama' al-Islamiyya's so-called Initiative to Stop the Violence, also known as Mubadarat Waqf al-Unf, on which I had recently published an article. As I strolled in and out of a handsome little row of bookshops on a street called Gumhuriya Street, I stumbled one day into a conversation with the proprietor and staff of Maktabat Wahba about the Gamal Islamiyya stream of revisionist writings in which its leadership had renounced their commitment to violence and declared themselves to have been wrong in carrying out their bloody campaign against the Egyptian state. Coincidentally, this was just after President Barack Hussein Obama's historic address at Cairo University. Having discovered, or I should say, having finally accepted that I was an American, much of my conversation with my new friend seemed to sputter along in what felt like a liminal space between the painful past and the uncertain future of the relationship between Islam and the West. In the end, however, the proprietor assured me that in about a week or two, he would provide me with the book that will settle this mess once and for all, putting an end to all of the errors, delusions, misapplications, and misrepresentations of jihad in both the East and the West. He did not tell me at the time, however, the title of this book of which he so enthusiastically spoke. It would not be for another few weeks that I would make the connection. Out of the blue, several reviews and editorials seemed to burst onto the pages of Egyptian newspapers, both mainstream and opposition, in which supporters and occasionally a mild critic analyzed the broad outlines and speculated on the likely impact of a new book by Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, entitled Fiqh al-Jihad. It was clear from the tone and the length of these features, some of them were actually serialized, that this work was making its debut on the tail end of a long stream of powerful anticipation. Upon learning that the book's publisher was none other than Maktabat Wahba, I returned to my friends on Gumhuriya Street to find stacks of the work freshly piled on the floor, literally just having been removed from their crates. I bought my copy, as it were, hot off the press. I had learned from the reviews and editorials I read that this was a very serious undertaking on the part of Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi. In contradistinction to the many smaller works he had penned, this was the result of more than 7 years of research and rumination. In fact, in terms of depth and comprehensiveness, al-Qaradawi himself compared Fiqh al-Jihad to his earlier magisterial work, Fiqh al-Zakat. Whether or not Fiqh al-Jihad would live up to the public fanfare it had generated, not to mention the endorsement of my new friend at Maktabat Wahba, this certainly seemed to be the aim that al-Qaradawi had in mind when he wrote this work. Fiqh al-Jihad falls into two hefty volumes of more than 1,200 pages of actual text, 1,246 pages to be exact. At bottom, its basic argument is that Islam is a religion of peace, not in the sense of being pacifist or rejecting violence on principle, but in the sense of preferring peaceful coexistence over armed conflict with non-Muslims who express no ill will towards Muslims. As for jihad, as Islam's religiously sanctioned institution of organized violence, al-Qaradawi is explicit in insisting that its raison d'etre is the defense of Islam against the encroachments of others, not to spread the religion by force, nor to bring all non-Muslims to heel before some global Muslim imperial power. All of this is set against the background, of course, of any number of starkly contrasting pre-modern and modern positions. Al-Qaradawi's aim is thus both to vindicate his view in light of those understandings that would challenge its legitimacy and to extract enough authority out of pre-modern and modern discussions on jihad and related subjects to sustain the possibility of raising his perspective to the status of the going opinion, or mashhur, in modern Islamic law and religious discourse, with the capacity to marginalize, if not subvert, the views of those who disagree with him. In his introduction, Al-Qaradawi situates himself among the three main views or perspectives on jihad espoused by modern Muslims. At one extreme are those who would jettison the concept of jihad as armed struggle altogether and limit its meaning and its function to the purely spiritual realm, where it would be directed solely against the inner adversary. Among the proponents of this view, he includes certain groups of Sufis, along with westernized secularists and various agents and supporters of imperial powers. At the other extreme are those who understand jihad to bind Muslims to declare war on the entire non-Muslim world, with no distinction to be observed between those who attack or express hostile intentions towards Muslims and those who do not. This group, in seeming agreement with Western scholars such as Patricia Crona, essentially understands the God of Islam to be an imperial God, Islam itself to be an imperial religion, and Muslims to be religiously obligated to pursue a policy of divinely enjoined imperialism. In this light, international organizations such as the United Nations and international treaties such as the Geneva Conventions have no meaning at all, as they stand in the way of the Muslim religious obligation to subdue all non-Muslims and basically treat them in this capacity as they, and only they, happen to see fit. Between these two groups, then, those of moderation and temperance, they neither see jihad as some kind of venereal disease to be quickly disposed of, nor as a blind declaration of war against the entire non-Muslim world. Rather, jihad is reserved solely for those who attack or express hostile intentions towards Muslims. As for those who are willing to live in peace with Muslims, there is no religious obligation, let alone, there is no religious justification, let alone any religious obligation, to fight them. This is the group in which Al-Qaradawi places himself. And according to him, he is joined in this regard by the likes of Muhammad Abdu, Muhammad Abu Zahra, Mahmoud Shaltut, Rashid Rida, Muhammad Al-Ghazali, Hassan Al-Banna, Sayyid Sabiq, Abdullah bin Zayd Al-Mahmoud, and others among the moderns. And Ibn Salah, Ibn Rushd the grandson, Ibn Taymiyyah, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, Ibn Qayyim Al-Jawziyyah, and others among the pre-moderns. It is clear from the outset that Al-Qaradawi's primary concern lies with the second group, the Hawks, Al-Hujumiyun, who advocate war against the entire world. It is thus to the displacement of this group's perspective that the rest of the book is basically devoted. The views of certain scholars out of Saudi Arabia seem to come in for special treatment, followed by, albeit with a bit more indulgence, those of Sayyid Qutb, Abu A'la al-Mawdudi, and the founder of Hizb al-Tahrir, or the Liberation Party, Taqiyuddin al-Nabahani. From the beginning, Al-Qaradawi makes it clear that he will give absolute primacy to the Qur'an, followed by the Sunnah of the Prophet. He will pay homage to the classical tradition of exegesis, law, and legal theory and the like, but he will neither assent to them blindly nor shy away from criticizing them. In fact, part of the problem, as he sees it, is that classical opinions often gain popularity to the point of coming to be viewed as the only legitimate position on a matter. Upon examination, however, one discovers not only that these are not the only opinions in circulation, but that they are not necessarily the strongest or even most plausible ones. In this light, Al-Qaradawi declares that he will not limit himself to the four Sunni schools, but will draw freely from the Zaydi, Ja'fari, Zahiri, and even Ibadi, i.e. Kharijite, traditions as well. And here, he will not hesitate to correct any number of sophistries and misunderstandings that may have reigned among the fuqaha for centuries. All of this is reflective of what he boldly presents as his understanding of due diligence in the enterprise of doing modern Islamic law. As he put it, and I quote, "True fiqh is not simply transmitting the contents of books, for books reflect their respective times and places. True fiqh obtains when the jurist engages in ijtihad for his own time and place, just as the ancients engaged in ijtihad for their time and place. Not everything that is appropriate for one time is necessarily appropriate for another, and not everything that is appropriate for one place is necessarily appropriate to another, especially given that the changes that have obtained in these our modern times are so very substantial indeed." As we proceed to a more substantive examination of Al-Qaradawi's thesis, it is important to bear in mind, again, that the issue for him is not whether jihad in the form of organized violence is a valid institution at Islamic law. Rather, the issue is whether the dictates of jihad make it obligatory or even permissible to target non-Muslims who conduct themselves peacefully towards Muslims. Al-Qaradawi's position is that it is emphatically not permissible, let alone obligatory, to attack non-Muslims under such circumstances. Again, however, he acknowledges that there are pre-modern and modern scholars who oppose this view. And as a preliminary to his critique of the latter, he enumerates the following as the primary proofs upon which they rely. One, there are eight of these. A number of Quranic verses, such as, "Fight them until there is no fitna," or oppression, "and religion is solely for God." Two, a number of prophetic hadith, such as, quote, "I have been commanded to fight the people until they say there is no God but God." Three, the precedent of the Prophet's numerous military campaigns against non-Muslims. Four, the precedent of the rightly guided caliph's campaigns against non-Muslims. Five, an alleged unanimous consensus, or ijma', to the effect that the Muslim community is religiously bound to invade non-Muslim territory at least once a year. Six, the principle that the efficient cause, or illah, for fighting against non-Muslims is indeed their non-Islam, or kufr, and that this efficient cause is enough in and of itself to obligate Muslims to fight them. Seven, the view that it is necessary to bring non-Muslims under Muslim control in order to enable them to see the efficacy of Islam as a lived reality. And eight, and finally, the so-called abrogation or sword verse, also known as Ayatul Saif. Al-Qaradawi takes up each of these proofs seriatim. Regarding some, he simply disputes their status as actual proof, such as with the claim of unanimous consensus or the view that non-Islam is an efficient cause to attack non-Muslims, a position he points out, incidentally, that was only upheld as the going opinion in the Shafi'i school. As for the other would-be proofs, he points out what he argues to be the plainly superior alternative constructions to be put upon the verses and prophetic statements and actions adduced, especially when these are placed in tandem with other explicit verses from the Quran, as well as the overall thrust of the Holy Writ. In all of this, he draws support from both pre-modern and modern authorities in an apparent effort to signal the extent to which his is not a completely de novo rendering, a move that becomes especially conspicuous when dealing with the historical precedent of the Prophet's military campaigns. In the end, however, there remains one nagging nemesis that seems to pop up all over the place, like a would-be forgotten cache of buried landmines, threatening to blast the life out of Al-Qaradawi's entire project. This is the so-called Ayatul Saif, whose ultimate effect was to deny access to all those Quranic verses that appear to suggest, with varying degrees of explicitness, that Islam's primary medium of exchange is argument, example, persuasion, and mutual cooperation, and that violence is reserved strictly for those who threaten the physical integrity of the Muslim community. What is this so-called ayatu saif? As we shall see, this question itself would become a point of contention. Among the pre-modern jurists who promulgated the concept, however, the general consensus was that it was the fifth verse of the ninth chapter, Surah At-Tawbah, itself believed to be among the last chapters of the Quran to be revealed. That verse reads as follows. So when the forbidden months have expired, slay the polytheists wherever you find them. Seize them, and lie in wait for them in every ambush. But if they repent, establish prayer, and pay the poor due, then clear their way. Verily, God is forgiving, merciful. Now, the argument promulgated by the ancients and seemingly absorbed into the very bloodstream of Muslim juridical discourse was that this verse had abrogated, i.e., nasakhat, all those verses in the Quran that suggest the possibility of a more civil relationship with non-Muslims. Indeed, Al-Qaradawi would depict the wanton power and influence of this verse in the following terms, and I quote here. If you adduce God's statement, there is no compulsion in religion. The distinction between guidance and misguidance has become manifest. They will say, this has been abrogated by ayatul saif. If you adduce God's statement, call to the way of your Lord with wisdom and beautiful exhortation, they will say, this has been abrogated by ayatul saif. If you adduce God's statement, and if they incline towards peace, then you incline thereto and place your trust in God, they will say, this has been abrogated by ayatul saif. If you adduce God's statement, if they withdraw from you such that they are preempted from attacking you, extending to you in effect an offer of peace, God has not granted you any way against them, they will say, this has been abrogated by ayatul saif. If you adduce God's statement, God does not forbid you to treat with goodness and justice those who do not fight you based on your religion and who do not drive you out of your homes, they will say, this has been abrogated by ayatul saif. On and on, ayatul saif proceeds, according to Al-Qaradawi, to decapitate verse after verse, leaving them as limp, spiritless, lifeless corpses. Indeed, at the hands of this veritable revelatory Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, some of you know this reference here to the Umayyad governor, some 114 verses are said to have met their fate. This, incidentally, was actually the conservative figure. Some authorities place the number of abrogated verses as high as 140, while others would top it off at a full 200 verses from the Quran. The end result would be that the Quran could never be appealed to as the source of a doctrine of mutual respect and non-aggression, not to mention cooperation between Muslims and non-Muslims. This compels Al-Qaradawi to take up the issue of abrogation or naskh in some earnest. Of course, the topic itself is hardly new. Western scholars such as John Burton, David Powers, Joseph Lowry, and my old classmate Christopher Melchert have produced important studies on the topic. This is not to mention the rich pedigree in the Islamic legal tradition going all the way back to the writings of Shafi'i, who died at the beginning of the 3rd-9th century. Compared to the meticulousness, detail, and comprehensiveness of these classical and Western treatments, Al-Qaradawi's treatment appears at first blush to be palpably superficial. Rather than attribute this, however, to any lack of scholarly acumen on his part, or to any unwillingness to confront potentially embarrassing controversies, such as the relationship between naskh and the integrity of the Quranic text, it might be more prudent to recognize that in this particular work, Al-Qaradawi is addressing a very specific audience with a palpably concrete goal in mind. He is not engaged, in other words, in an academic exercise, but in a definitively practical one. His point of departure is neither the kind of rootin' tootin' foundationalism that characterized much of formative and classical Islam, nor the ostensible tabula rasa of the modern Western academy. Al-Qaradawi's concern rests rather with the actual state of contemporary Muslim thought, including the various concrete historical accretions that have informed it. In this context, in order for him to realize and be able to sustain his overall objective, he must steer clear of both confusing his modern Muslim audience and of alienating them from their religious and intellectual tradition, given that his attempt will ultimately be to ingratiate them with a palpably different deployment of that very tradition. Al-Qaradawi begins by expressing disappointment and bewilderment at the notion that a concept as far-reaching and potentially subversive to the authority of the Qur'an as naskh could gain so much currency among the fuqaha. At the same time, however, he will draw on the very tradition of the fuqaha in order to undermine the authority, or at least the impact, of naskh. Essentially, Al-Qaradawi will argue that naskh, or abrogation, in the sense of a later verse rescinding the legal implications laid down by an earlier one, could only be sustained on the basis of absolutely apodictic proof, dalil qat'i, or burhan qat'i, as he puts it. Once, however, the proofs of those who advocate abrogation are actually examined, they will all be found to fall short of this basic criterion. In this way, Al-Qaradawi is able to subvert, on the one hand, or at least severely limit, the actual application of naskh, without categorically denying, on the other hand, its theoretical validity. In other words, rather than oppose the classical fuqaha in toto, Al-Qaradawi will argue that a more faithful adherence to their very criteria will justify, if not compel, a patently negative attitude towards naskh. Thus he states, and I quote, "If we apply the rules, strictures, and preconditions laid down by the scholars of the principles of religion, the scholars of legal theory, the scholars of the principles of exegesis, and the scholars of the principles of hadith sciences, we will hardly find, nay, we will not find, a single verse from the Quran whose abrogation can be established with absolute certainty." Al-Qaradawi enumerates three basic proofs relied upon by those whom he depicts as naskh-happy fuqaha. First, there are a series of verses from Surah Al-Baqarah and Surah Al-Nahl. Surah Al-Baqarah, verses 106-8, read as follows. "We do not cause a verse to be abrogated or forgotten without bringing forth one that is better than or like it. Do you not know that God has power over all things? Do you not know that God owns the dominion of the heavens and the earth, and that you have besides him neither friend nor helper? Or do you wish to inundate your messenger with questions, as Moses was inundated before you?" That's Surah Al-Baqarah. As for Surah Al-Nahl, verse 101, it reads, "And when we exchange one verse for another, and God knows best what he reveals, they say, you are simply a forger. Nay, most of them know not." The second major proof of the supporters of naskh is the fact that tradition itself so widely recognizes it, as attested to by the fact that all of the books of exegesis cited, it is a standard feature in virtually all of the books of legal theory, and even a number of prominent jurists wrote monographs devoted specifically to the topic. Men such as Abu Ubaid, Abu Ja'far al-Nahhas, Abu Bakr ibn al-Arabi, and others. The final proof is the actual occurrence of naskh in Islamic law, based on the presumed irreconcilability between certain verses in the Quran. For example, the verse in Surah Al-Baqarah that places the waiting period for widows at 4 months and 10 days, And then the verse in Surah An-Nisa that grants widows the benefits of a waiting period that extends up to an entire year. Al-Qaradawi proceeds to cross-examine these proofs with the aim of showing that they are not apodictic. To make a rather long and detailed story short, regarding the verses in Surah Al-Baqarah and Surah An-Nahl, Al-Qaradawi enlists the view of those who interpret these verses to refer not to any substitution of one for another Quranic verse or ruling, but to Islam's abrogation or rescission of the legal order implied by previous dispensations, i.e. that of the Jews and the Christians. Similarly, he argues that there is nothing in the Sunnah that explicitly identifies naskh or abrogation as an operative principle in the religion. As for unanimous consensus or ijma', Al-Qaradawi flatly insists that there simply is no such consensus, neither on the theoretical possibility nor the actual occurrence of abrogation in the Qur'an. In fact, he notes that there is hardly a verse in the Qur'an regarding which scholars make a claim of naskh, but that other scholars are found who oppose this claim. Interestingly, he cites in this regard, among others, the view of one Abu Muslim al-Isfahani, whom he unceremoniously identifies as a Mu'tazilite. This is quite a big deal in this context. As for the notion of reverting to naskh in the face of irreconcilable verses, Al-Qaradawi reiterates the principle upheld even by classical scholars to the effect that the contradiction in such cases must be not apparent, but both actual and absolute. In other words, the presumably contradictory language of both verses must be univocal to the point of not accommodating any alternative interpretations, and it cannot be possible to reconcile the verses through such means as restricting their scope, takhsis al-am, qualifying their reference, taqyid al-mutlaq, or drawing simple exceptions, istithna, based on other legitimate considerations. Here, in fact, Al-Qaradawi complains in several places that one of the reasons that so many claims to naskh are made is that later scholars often overlook the fact that earlier scholars used the term naskh, or abrogation, to refer not to the displacement of one verse or ruling by another, but to such procedures as restricting scope, qualifying reference, drawing simple exceptions, and other such synthetic modifications. Beyond this, there are three additional arguments that Al-Qaradawi adds in his effort to loosen the grip of abrogation, and with it, the so-called ayatul sayf, over the minds of his readers. The first of these relates to the actual identification of ayatul sayf itself. Here, he reports that there was not one, but at least four verses that had been accorded this proud preeminence. These all occurred in the ninth chapter of the Qur'an, Surah At-Tawbah, and included verses 5, 29, 36, and 41. Verses 5, 29, 36, and 41. Of course, the cumulative insinuation behind all of this is that this level of confusion must at least give pause to the reliability of a concept that is to be credited with the power and ability to set aside actual divine revelation. The second argument relates to the actual means by which one can know that one verse has indeed abrogated another. Beyond the general tendency to rely on chronology alone, Al-Qaradawi insists that since abrogation entails the rescission of a rule that was instituted, or at least confirmed by the Prophet, there must be a reliable transmission from the Prophet himself to the effect that such abrogation has actually taken place. Quoting As-Suyuti's Al-Itqan fi Ulum al-Qur'an, Al-Qaradawi insists that one cannot rely on the casual statements of the exegetes or even those of the mujtahids in the absence of a sound narration on the authority of the Prophet to back their claims. Indeed, even when companions affirm an instance of abrogation, it must be determined that they were not simply speaking on the basis of their own interpretive discretion, but were rather relaying an explicit teaching from the Prophet himself. On this criterion, Al-Qaradawi concludes, and I quote, "I do not know of a single explicit narration on the authority of the Prophet, wherein it is stated that such and such verse has abrogated such and such verse. And whoever knows of such a narration, let him direct me to it." End of quote. Here, actually, speaking parenthetically, I think Al-Qaradawi may have actually overplayed his hand. For the Prophet's explicit recognition of the shares of inheritance in place of free-flowing bequests could have been pointed to as a legitimate instance of naskh, which might have spared him the risk of being seen as effectively sweeping under the rug such an obvious example of abrogation in the Qur'an. Finally, Al-Qaradawi comes full circle in what might be taken as a gesture of conciliation. He cites the 8th/14th century jurist Az-Zarkashi, who was a Shafi'i incidentally, whose interpretation of naskh in connection with Ayatul Sayf might be described as organic. According to Zarkashi, naskh in this context is not a full rescission of a verse or ruling, but merely the fixing of a rule so that it follows the presence or absence of its raison d'etre, or sabab. As Zarkashi apparently takes the word nunsi in the verse "Man nansakh min ayatin aw nunsiha" from Surah Al-Baqarah to be not from the root nasiya, which would render the meaning of the verse "we do not cause to be forgotten," i.e. abrogated, but from the verb nasa'a, with a final hamza, which renders the meaning of the verse "we do not cause to be postponed." The actual cause and duration of postponement, however, according to Zarkashi, is connected to the concrete circumstances facing the Muslims on the ground. In other words, Ayatul Sayf may be said to have postponed the application of any number of the many verses it is said to have abrogated, but it should not be said to have rescinded or abrogated these verses. For under the right circumstances, all of these verses would be fully operational and remain so as long as circumstances dictated. Of course, given the reality of what I have described elsewhere as the overall state of war that characterized the pre-modern world, where in the absence of a United Nations or a notion of territorial integrity, communities tend to exist either in an offensive or a defensive state, as Zarkashi almost certainly had in mind the notion that Muslims could maintain peace with non-Muslims as long as circumstances prevented them from taking the offensive. For his part, Al-Qaradawi recognizes both the likelihood that this was Zarkashi's understanding and the fact that Muslims no longer occupy the kind of world that shaped Zarkashi's geopolitical presumptions. Thus, while Zarkashi's construction allows Al-Qaradawi to potentially ingratiate himself with would-be critics by paying additional homage to at least a classical notion of naskh and its connection to Ayatul Sayf, he also sees fit in this context to add a qualifying addendum. Quote, "As for interpreting postponement here to mean that we will refrain from attacking others as long as we are in a state of weakness, but in a state of strength, we will attack the entire world, those who attack us, as well as those who refrain from attacking us, and extend to us instead an offer of peace, as the hawks and advocates of war against the world say, this is precisely what we reject, as it contradicts so many verses in the Qur'an, in Surah Al-Baqarah, in Surah Al-Nisa, in Surah Al-Anfal, in Surah Al-Mumtahina, in Surah Al-Tawbah itself, that is the very site of the alleged Ayatul Sayf." To conclude, the notion that jihad is a purely defensive institution is not entirely new, but it does appear to be modern, at least as a would-be going opinion. How much, however, the pre-modern disposition was indebted to scripture and how much to geopolitical reality is another matter, one I think that has not always received the attention it deserves. As I myself have intimated elsewhere, following the lead of such scholars as Fred Donner, if the pre-modern world was one in which to be on defense meant essentially to be under attack, it would have been nothing short of grotesque for jihad to emerge as a purely defensive mechanism. This, however, is no longer the world in which we live. And one of the challenges confronting modern Muslims is whether they can adjust their understanding of Islam to accommodate this new reality. To be sure, for those who see scriptural interpretation as an essentially unstoried, purely rational enterprise, this may appear to be a simple matter of reapproaching scripture with new interpretive schemas. But for those who operate out of an interpretive tradition, new interpretations must always vindicate themselves to one degree or another in conversation with old ones. Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi operates out of an interpretive tradition. Yet he recognizes that we no longer live in a world that is characterized by an overall state of war, in which the main, if not only consideration, informing a decision to attack or not a foreign power was the material cost and likelihood of success. In this context, al-Qaradawi is explicit in affirming that jihad is a defensive mechanism that is directed only against those, and I quote, who attack the persons, property, lands, or religion of the Muslims in an attempt to undermine the latter or block the path to it, or those who oppress the weak among the Muslims or their allies. Having said this much, al-Qaradawi recognizes that this position must be vindicated in the context of a tradition that has been shaped by its own particular set of realities, obsessions, and sensibilities. In that tradition, Ayatollah Saif most likely operated as a means of inoculating Muslims against the tendencies to drop their defenses, a tendency that many might point to in explaining the entire colonial experience. While al-Qaradawi is alive to these considerations, he lends no credibility to the blind presumption that all non-Muslims are out to destroy Islam. In this light, not only does Ayatollah Saif impose what he considers to be palpable distortions upon the overall Quranic message, it carries practical liabilities that contemporary Muslims can no longer afford to ignore. As for jihad itself, al-Qaradawi is explicit in noting that in this age of satellite TV, air travel, radio, print media, and the internet, violence is no longer the greatest threat posed by those who harbor ill will towards Muslims. And just as violence is no longer the greatest threat, no longer is it an appropriate, not to mention effective response. Thus, rather than declaring war against the world, what Muslims today need is, and I quote, a massive army of preachers, teachers, journalists, and those who are competent in training people how to address today's public in the language of the age and the style of the times. Through voice, image, spoken word, physical gesture, books, pamphlets, magazines, newspapers, dialogue, documentaries, drama, and motion pictures. End of quote. While Muslims, according to al-Qaradawi, have thus far failed to develop as much as one-tenth of what is needed in this regard, this, according to him, and not militarized confrontation, is the very jihad of our times. Thank you very much.